How can the high-tech toolbox of neuroscientists who study brain waves and colorful images of our gray matter, how can that toolbox help us figure out what our brain is up to? Can you see what is happening in your brain? And if you can, does knowing how your brain functions help you function better? My guest has considered that and many other questions about the workings of the brain in everyday life, from what athletes are thinking when they are in the zone, to the reasons we laugh or fear, or have difficulty paying attention, or love. Well, joining me now to talk about it is Stephen Johnson. He's the author of Mind Wide Open, Your Brain and the Neuroscience of Everyday Life, and he writes the Emerging Technologies column for Discover magazine, and he's here in our studios in New York. Thank you for coming in.
I think we've all been in that situation when someone is saying one thing, but their face is saying another.
Do you feel like you're a better liar now that you know, that you're aware that your face may betray you?
I think actually I'm a worse liar because I think about it. I'm very conscious of it. I'm aware of everything I'm betraying with all these micro expressions on my face.
So the poker face just goes away
exactly,
now.
Exactly.
It just
exactly,
betrays yeah. everything. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You write about a lot of different things, and you decided to, subject yourself to all of these new kinds of tests. Tell us a little about some of these.
Well, the mission of this book for me was I'd read all these wonderful books by some guests that you've had on the show that talk about how the brain works and this wonderful understanding that we're developing of emotions and of consciousness and how the brain evolved. But I kept finding myself wrestling with this question that I felt wasn't really being answered by these books, which is, in a sense, what's in it for me? I mean, what could I learn about, not about how the brain evolved or how the brain works in the abstract, but how my brain works? Could mm-hmm. I use the lens of kind of science to learn about myself as an individual, what makes me unique? And so I decided to go on this kind of little adventure, kind of inner exploration, both in terms of going around and talking to some of the great scientists that are out there and asking them this question, the same question, how has what they know about the brain changed their own sense of self, mm-hmm. but also to subject myself to as many kind of tests and scans as I could to catch a glimpse of what was going on inside and see if that would teach me something new. And it began actually with this very interesting little experiment that I did with biofeedback, which is a kind of technology that that reads some kind of real-time information about the body's kind of physiological state and puts it onto a computer so that you can see it as it's changing. And in my case, I was looking at my adrenaline levels, which you can kind of measure by looking at the sweat glands on the palms. This is what a lie detector test is doing most of the time, except that you get to see the results. I mean, that's
right,
the difference.
Right, right.
And so I sat down with this biofeedback therapist, and we started talking, and you could see this little line going across the screen. And initially, my adrenaline levels were very even. The line didn't move around very much. And in fact, the therapist actually complimented me on having a very well-regulated adrenal system.
Is that code for you're a good liar?
I don't know what it was. I was like, well, thank you very much. I'm very flattered to hear this.
You could fool a machine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I all of a sudden, as I often do in passing, I decided to make a joke. And I threw out a little joke, and he laughed, and I laughed. And all of a sudden, we turned to the screen, and there's this huge spike on the monitor. And at the end of the session, he printed out, kind of a chart of the 30 minutes we talked. And it was, for all intents and purposes, a chart of my attempts at humor over the preceding 30 minutes. It was a flat line with six spikes, each of them corresponding to a joke that I tried to make. And I looked at that, and I thought of all the times in the past that I'd, made jokes in kind of inappropriate situations, or what I teach, I have to kind of turn off the inner stand-up comic in me, actually, teach my students something. And I could recognize myself in those little adrenaline spikes, but I never realized that I was delivering this kind of jolt of a drug, in a sense, to my brain every time I made a joke. And so I thought, what else is going on in there? What else could I learn if I looked at myself kind of through that kind of lens?
Did you get any better sense about what consciousness means?
I tried to deliberately run away from the question of consciousness in this book because it's a fascinating one, and I've loved some of the books about them. But it is a really – the question of – what's sometimes called qualia. Why does red wine taste the way it does? Why does light look the way it does? Why are we self-aware? It's just such a huge question, and I don't know if we have the answer yet. And the problem is once you start talking about it, all conversations tend to kind of gravitate towards this one big question. And so what I said was, look, for instance, in that biofeedback story about my adrenaline, I don't have a theory and I don't know of a theory that can fully account for why adrenaline feels the way it does.
Mm-hmm.
But I can nonetheless say a lot of interesting things about the way the patterns of kind of adrenaline release in my body and how they shape who I am and how they alter my behavior. So I don't necessarily have to explain the kind of consciousness of adrenaline to learn something useful about the brain.
We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be back with more conversation with Stephen Johnson about the mind. This program is pre-recorded, so please don't try to call in. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with author Stephen Johnson about what's going on inside his brain. So then you said, "Hey, let's go into more of these little tools, the toys that the neuroscientists use."
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by one that you did where you were hooked up to by a helmet to record your brain waves, and you tried to learn how to focus on something.
Yeah, this is a variation of biofeedback called neurofeedback, which is looking at the brainwave activity that you can measure on the outside of the skull. It's not invasive or anything. I did no surgery for this book.
Right.
And basically, there are a set of kind of five or six major kind of waveform patterns that people have identified that have names like alpha and beta and theta. And they're associated with specific states. So theta and beta are associated with attention and distraction. If you have low theta levels and high beta levels, you're generally in a pretty focused, attentive state. So the idea of this technology is that by taking this information from your brain and showing it to you on a computer as it's actually unfolding, you can get better at kind of, in a sense, pushing your brain into the state you desire,
right.
getting a sense of what it feels like to be in this focused state. And they've partially because they're experimenting with doing this to treat ADD, they've designed the interface on the computers to look like video games. And so you're encouraged in the software, if you get to this more attentive state, you have a little bicycle on screen that pedals faster if you get towards this more attentive state. So I tried this thing on, and initially we had it kind of set up in a kind of strange way, which is another more detailed story I won't get into. But eventually, once we had it actually mm-hmm. working properly, I could drive this bicycle across the screen at will just by thinking a certain type of thought in my head, by thinking, okay, I'm going to focus. And the bicycle,
right.
sure enough, would move, and I would think kind of distracted thoughts, and it would slow down. It was the closest thing to
yeah.
a kind of telekinesis than I've ever experienced.
Could they train people who have ADD to try to focus more by riding that bicycle?
That's the question. I just don't know enough about the actual – I don't think that there's enough evidence
right.
either way on this. But it is clear that you can – manipulate it using, you can control your brain waves. And I mean, I know firsthand that you can actually control it while you're wearing the helmet or while the electrodes are attached to your head. Whether you can then take the knowledge and the experience and the training you get from that and apply it in the real world when you're not wearing the helmet, when you're not attached to the machine, I think that's the question we're going to find out.
Well, if you're now in this book, you talk about going through taking all different kinds of tests. And becoming aware of how your brain is reacting. Does at some point you realize your brain is just a giant battery with a lot of electricity and chemicals going on? There's no romance left to your brain anymore? You know, is Freud all wrong when he talked about, thoughts and feelings and stuff like that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I found through the whole process that I'm filled with more wonder because the brain, what you learn is that the brain is this incredibly complex thing, and the kind of modern neuroscientific explanation of how it works is much more complex than Freud's model was.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's some important things that Freud contributed, it's become much more kind of diverse in our understanding. The weird thing that does occur to you, I think, when you delve into this stuff, and some of the people who read the book say that this is an experience they get reading the book, which is that you get the sense of your own brain as being this kind of toolbox made up of all these different component parts that are all working simultaneously, none of which exactly is you.
Mm-hmm.
You are the sum of all these different parts that are working at the same time. And so in a sense, you get this weird feeling occasionally of being one and many at the same time. And that can be a little bit uncanny when you kind of wrestle with it. But it goes away.
Does at some point
you realize your brain is just a giant battery with a lot of electricity and chemicals going on. There's no romance left to your brain anymore. You know, is Freud all wrong when he talked about, you know, thoughts and feelings and stuff like that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I found through the whole process that I'm filled with more wonder because the brain, what you learn is that the brain is this incredibly complex thing, and the kind of modern neuroscientific explanation of how it works is much more complex than Freud's model was. Mm-hmm. Although there's some important things that Freud contributed, it's become much more kind of diverse in our understanding. The weird thing that does occur to you, I think, when you delve into this stuff, and some of the people who read the book say that this is an experience they get reading the book, which is that you get the sense of your own brain as being this kind of toolbox made up of all these different component parts that are all working simultaneously, none of which exactly is you. Mm-hmm. You know, you are the sum of all these different parts that are working at the same time. And so in a sense, you get this weird feeling occasionally of being one and many at the same time. And that can be a little bit uncanny when you kind of wrestle with it. But yeah. It goes away.
So much of this brain function you talk about is centered in the amygdala. Tell us what you really talk about. I see it. I'm subconsciously, your eyebrows raised
right,
up
right,
and down.
Yeah.
Now I'm watching your face.
The amygdala is my best friend now, I feel like. Well, the amygdala, you know, should become, I think, a popular word. I mean, we talk about things like an adrenaline high, and mm-hmm. we talk now about serotonin because of Prozac. And it seems to me the amygdala is kind of the next big celebrity of the brain that should become a kind of household term because it's really, in a lot of ways, the seat of kind of emotional processing. And it does a number of different things. But in the example you gave at the beginning where you're recognizing a subtle kind of micro-expression on somebody's face or you're issuing forth an expression that's an emotional expression, the amygdala is kind of in charge of that process. And the important thing about it is that we aren't often consciously in control of our faces. So in a situation like that where you're trying to look concerned about your colleague, but that smile leaks out of the side of your face, you know, in a sense, who's in control there? Actually, what's happening is that your face is controlled by two different parts of your brain. And every now and then, your amygdala, which is really expressing your kind of inner emotions, is at odds with the part of your brain that is trying to kind of figure out what's the appropriate thing logically to do in this social setting. Mm-hmm. And most of the time those things are in sync with each other, but every now and then they're not. And that's where you have yourself betraying your emotions. And that's where you can get that sense of your brain being this modular thing where there are multiple parts kind of working at the same time.
You write about autism and how many autistic people can't seem to do that mind reading, looking at social cues and grasping the nuances of social interactions. Can they be trained to do this?
Yeah, they can. And they believe actually that some of the disorder revolves around the amygdala, our friend from before. They lack the ability to pick up on these subtle micro expressions that most humans are extremely good at picking up. And they can learn it. And there's been software that's been developed that will sit there and show you emotional expressions on people's faces and explain this is angry, this is arrogant, this is panicked. And you can learn it literally the way you would learn a foreign language. I don't think they ever get to the point where it's as fluid as, in a sense, our first language of kind of being able to read these mm-hmm. these faces. But they can get better at it, certainly.
What was the thing you learned most, the most surprising thing you discovered about the brain?
Well, I think part of it is the importance of shutting down as opposed to building up. I mean, there's a tendency to think of this in kind of the gym metaphor that, oh, we're going to get our bodies in shape and now we're going to go to the brain gym and build up our mental muscles and stuff like
right.
that. But, for instance, the very last kind of adventure I go on is doing this fMRI, which is kind of the state-of-the-art functional magnetic resonance imaging, state-of-the-art brain scanning technology. And I'd had this idea that I wanted to capture my brain coming up with a new idea. That's, I mean, it's such a mystical kind of moment when you're sitting there without an idea and all of a sudden it just pops into your head, something good, some new insight about something.
You know, and meanwhile, you're all hooked up to the scanner
that's taking images of your brain.
Right?
What I wanted to figure out a way is could I stick my head into this, you know, $5 million machine and come up with an idea while the, you know, cameras are rolling. They aren't really cameras. And so we devised this experiment where I ran through a couple of things, but then I would look at a passage from the book that I was in the middle of writing that I had recently written. And the idea was that I would maybe, seeing this new passage that I was working on, it would inspire me to have some new thought while my head was in the middle of this fMRI. And we did two takes of it. Just for a backup. And the first time through, I just completely couldn't come up with anything because it's an incredibly claustrophobic space. It's really it's the least hospitable environment for coming up with an idea. But the second time, I decided to just compose a little sentence or two for the book since I was already imagining how I was going to describe the fMRI. And so for the 30 seconds it was scanning, I actually built a little sentence in my head that shows up in the book and, you know, it was coherent enough that I could type it out 2 days later at the computer. 5 days later, we get the scans back, and the difference between those two takes was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen in my life. And basically, the difference is there was vastly more activity in the scan when I was failing to come up with an idea, and much, much less, in fact, less activity than in any other scan that I did the entire session in the one when I was doing what ostensibly my brain does best, writing a sentence.
That hard drive just grinding away, trying to come up with something.
When I was failing, it was like there was a five-alarm fire in my brain. You know, somebody think of something, something. Yeah. And athletes talk about this when they talk about getting their head out of their game. You know, they're shutting down and let their muscle memory do what it needs to do. And Tiger Woods seems to be kind of incredibly good at just getting into this almost meditative state.
That's the zone.
Yeah, the zone is really about turning your brain off. Yeah.
They say that, yeah, I'm really at my best when I'm relaxed and sitting at the plate.
Exactly. This
is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's go to the phone, see if we can get a call in here. Mike from New Jersey. Hi, Mike.
How are you? I wanted to touch on something you were just talking about, being in the zone. Like, I watched a show on Discovery Channel, and they were showing a martial artist, and he was showing, like, it had all electrodes hooked up to his brain, and he was breaking a brick, and he's focusing on breaking the brick, and then right before he gets there, all brain activity almost ceases. And that's right when he goes through, and he hits the bricks. And I was just wondering, like, what exactly is going on in the brain?
Steve?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I mean, it's like what we were just saying. There's this idea that's being developed about kind of efficiency models of brain activity that basically again, your brain is made up of all these different tools that are kind of specialized for different tasks. And what you want to be doing is not, as sometimes people say, you know, imagine if we could use 100% of our brains. We only use 10% or whatever, right. That kind of folklore story. You know, you don't want to use 100% of your brain because it's like using all the tools in your toolbox, you know, to hammer a nail. And you want the hammer exactly at that moment. And so what he's no doubt doing, I would suspect that there are certain parts of his brain that are still active. There are certain parts of the brainstem, for instance, that are keeping him breathing and his heart rate going and all these kind of basic metabolic functions. But, you know, he's basically able to shut down all the things that are not relevant to the task at hand and really, in a sense, concentrate just the resources to what he needs to do. And that's a difficult skill. And some of us probably have certain things that we're good at doing that with. For instance, I took some attention tests. And attention is one of these things that has, you know, there are a bunch of kind of sub-tools that make up attention. So you can be very good at listening but not very good at looking. You can be very good at translating things to memory but not very good at just kind of perceiving them in real time. And you can take these tests that will tell you exactly where you score on all these different kind of sub-faculties. I, for instance, am not very good at visual encoding, which just means walking into a room and kind of storing what I see into memory. So, you know, having learned that now, I can't really undo it. I can't, you know, get rid of this liability that I have.
You can't practice and make it better.
But what you can do is you can develop little kind of cheats, you know, in a sense. So you go in when you're in a situation where you know it's going to be important to remember what you're seeing, you have to consciously say to yourself, okay, I'm not particularly good at this, so remember that and remember that and look over there and remember that.
So it might be good for people to be able to get to these little toolboxes that you got to. Is there any place you can go and put your head in a scanner or get on that bicycle and we can discover about our brain so we can get the advantages that you have now on all of us?
Yes, right.
It'd be great to have a little spot in the mall, you know?
I'm not going to reveal where those places are because I don't want you to have my advantages. No, I think there probably will be some cunning entrepreneur will put all this together. I haven't come across a place that does all this at once. You know, the analogy I like to use is think about the way that our diets have changed over the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, when you used to go on a diet 30 or 40 years ago, you would, you know, basically stop eating dessert. That was the extent to which we talked about it. And now we've got omega-3s and good and bad carbohydrates. Well, our language in terms of our brain and our sense of self, I think, is going to hit a newfound kind of complexity to it.
So I talked about this with Freud before. I mean, is he still legitimate now? If we have all these drugs and we have all these, you know, these feedback and whatever to solve our – no more lying down on the couch and telling me your problems, you know?
No, I don't think so. The last chapter of the book actually talks about the legacy of Freud and how relevant he is. I think you need to you certainly need to update the language. And there, you know, if you look in the brain, there isn't really an id and an ego and a superego. But the core insights that that the self is divided and that there are these kind of parts below the center of the kind of unified self that are sometimes in conflict with each other, which was a radical idea when he originally proposed it. That has certainly been verified by the lens of science in the last 20 or 30 years. And so he remains relevant in that sense, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. Stephen Johnson, author of the best-selling Mind Wide Open, Your Brain and the Neuroscience of Everyday Life, just out by Scribner. It's really a great book, an excellent book.
Thank you.
You want to read it. It's just fascinating. You're not going to think about yourself anymore. And we've got to find out where to find those machines.
You're right.
We'll create them ourselves.
Yeah.
He also writes the Emerging Technology column for our Discover magazine. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks again.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us at our internet address, which is scifry@npr.org, or surf over and visit our website at www.sciencefriday.com. We also find Science Friday's Kids Connection. And also, you can listen to archive versions of Science Friday on your Audible player or listen on Real Audio. From New York, I'm Ira Flatow.